F2. Number 29A.
If we deviate, we are no more safe. So, also in this way, I would like to give a balanced sense of our study, that we don't take now thought and energy and the love away from those wonderful teachers, the textbook and the Bible, and make our teaching, our presentation, our book more important than those books. That would be just the devil behind it. Just the devil behind it. We like to write these books, we just can't help to write these books, because we know that's the way how we can awake thought to see what is in the Bible and what is in the textbook, and what much more can be found in the Bible and in the textbook. So, is that, have I made myself clear also on this point? Because that is dear to my heart. I have such a admiration and awe, not only of Mrs. Eddy, but of her textbook, that I just feel if I would do anything to distract, to take away any attention from that book, I would really not do the job I have to do. And I would not feel justified to do it. Well, that's that. So, we know something about that consciousness which takes away the veil and is now able to pierce deeper and deeper in those two books. Now, having shown how the revelation of the Christ has developed through all the ages up to this present age, we now begin to perceive, you see, that reality operates in the seven and the four. Now the four is, I think, the highest category because it shows the modus operandi of being. It shows the rhythm, the working of being. And those four are four aspects of the one being. But we know that in reality, every aspect of being reflects every other aspect of being. That you can't put apart the one being into four parts. You only have that method of science, which is called science, to analyze this one being, but not to put it into parts. So, we have to see that each side of the city reflects the other side of the city. That the world is not only just the world, but that it reflects the Christ and Christianity and science. And this 4x4 we have termed a matrix. Because in representing it as a chart, we use the same method as the mathematician uses when he calculates in matrices. Matrices is a mode of calculation in higher mathematics. Now, let us see the position of the epistles within that matrix. You see, the 4x4, 16, is something very fundamental, therefore, in being. But, this 4x4 appears in the scriptures at various times. Just to pinpoint the view, we have 16 prophets. We have now the 16 standpoints in the epistles. But we also have, say, 16 chapters in the Christian Science textbook. So we can see this 16, therefore this 4x4, the explanation of the four sides of the holy city reflecting each other so as to make it a whole, is something which appears in the line of revelation from time to time. Now, do they appear always in the same way? No, they don't appear in the same way. The 16 prophets have a very different office, say, than the 16 standpoints of the epistles. And they again have a very different office in being than the 16 chapters in Science and Health. I think that's quite clear. So you see that this 4x4 has various shadings. It has another shading in the prophets, it has another shading in the epistles, and it has another shading in the textbook. And what therefore is of greatest interest for us is to recognize what is that difference. If fundamentally they are the 4x4, and yet they appear in a different way and for a different purpose, what is that difference? And so lately we began to realize that we can't just speak about one matrix, that we begin to see that this matrix again reflects all four sides of the city. See, reflection is infinite, Mrs. Eddy says. It's an infinite reflection. So every analysis into factors, into elements, is always only one aspect of it. So what we begin to realize is this, that those 16 in the prophets show the whole matrix from the overall view of the Christ. They present the Christ in being, the Christ in being from all 16 standpoints. And we have touched on the epistles and began to see that what the epistles present is Christianity. Namely, the focus in the epistle is man. What is man's reciprocal relationship to the word Christ, Christianity, and science? So the focus is man, which is Christianity. So we have here a matrix, the 4x4, but the whole is under the aspect of Christianity. And so in the textbook, again, we have something else. We have there 16 chapters. They illustrate the 4x4. But again, from another aspect, namely from the aspect of science. So what we have up to now is that we have a Christ matrix in the prophets, a Christianity matrix, as we see it today in the epistles, and a science matrix in the textbook. You may ask me, where is the word matrix? I left out that one. My answer is, I don't know. I just haven't the faintest idea. So I think it's just honest if I say I don't know yet. See, it hasn't been revealed, and I'm not a bit disturbed about it. I'm never disturbed about it if something is not revealed, because I know it comes when I'm ready for it. And it comes if anybody's ready for it. Comes to anybody. And each one helps the other one to be more receptive for what's going on. So we see how each contribution in the way of science is not something personal and doesn't remain personal. Each one who picks it up, so to say, picks it up, it can take part and partakes of this higher understanding, and is made ready for a higher understanding. Must Christian Science come through the churches? No. Must it come through a person? No. Must it come through only one person? No. It comes according to God's appointing. We can't outline it through whom, through what it should come. We only can know it does come. And it has come since Adam, that Christ just doesn't rest until he overturns and overturns and overturns until he comes whose right it is. And we just can't trust that. It must be impersonal enough about it that we accept it when it comes, no matter how it comes and through whom it comes. There is no reason why it shouldn't come through the Russians. There's no reason why it shouldn't. God does according to God's appointing. If we are men, we wouldn't mind. We wouldn't mind if it comes through anything. Through a book, or through a person, or through whom. Doesn't matter. If we just open our consciousness and see it's God interpreting himself in his way, and he using just that which let itself be used by it. Then we are men, then we are wide open, then we are not restricted, then we don't generalize God's working, then we are ready to receive what comes. And we will take part in the grace of God. So let's see that we have these matrices. Now, what is this Christianity matrix telling us? So let's turn to page 42, yes. And just have a survey of it, what it really means. See, this is, as far as we see it, the Christianity matrix. Why Christianity? Again, I say it because the focal point is man. It's man. And therefore, it shows man within that whole system of Christianity. So at the top I have the title showing that it is a reciprocal relation of man to the four sides. Now, if we would only consider Christianity from the level of divine science, divine science is that level where everything is considered from the point of view of oneness. Whenever we view any metaphysical proposition from the point of view of oneness, from the infinite one, you see, then we are thinking and reasoning on the level of divine science. From that level of divine science, we would just see man as what he is from the point of view of oneness in God. Namely, that man and God are one. That would be the level of divine science, where we just would have that sense where Mrs. Eddy says, in divine science, man is the true image of God. The Christ-like understanding and scientific being and divine healing includes what? A perfect principle and idea. Perfect God and perfect man as the basis of thought and demonstration. So, you see, as long as we would only reason from the point of view of oneness, which we like to do and which is right to start, that God and man is one, that there is perfect God and perfect man, that there is a oneness between God and man, I and my Father are one, then Jesus reasoned about man from the level of divine science. Just oneness. Now, this oneness naturally lies really at the foundation of all the epistles. All the epistles fundamentally acknowledge, either expressly or unexpressed in the text, that man is holy. That's why he addresses them as, say, as your saints in Rome, or as holy before God, or anything like that, you see. So through the whole text of the epistle goes one strain which recurs and recurs in every epistle, namely that man is perfect, that he is the Son of God. You see, the oneness of God and man. So that title I have really would be the title of Christianity on the level, if we could tabulate it or put it in chart, really the level of divine science. That man is one with God, is perfect. So that idea goes through all the 16 standpoints. You see, it goes through all the 16 standpoints. That's why it's above the chart. That which is above the chart is always that which is everywhere within the chart. Is that clear? Now, we can't just stay in consciousness at that point where we just try to feel and to touch what it means that God and man is one. Thought then says, well, what are the constituents of this oneness? How is that, I think that's the best term, the constituents of this oneness. What makes up this oneness? What are the aspects of this oneness? And the moment I begin to reason about the relationship of this oneness, you see, the moment I begin to reason about the relationship between oneness, between the relationship between principle and idea, then I touch absolute Christian science. That's the plane of absolute Christian science, where you begin to reason things out of this oneness, where you no more just are satisfied with saying, well, God and man is one. There is but one thing going on, perfect God and perfect man, perfect principle and perfect idea. You say, well, what is that oneness? And the moment one begins to analyze that oneness and see it in its constituents, that's the level of what Mrs. Eddy speaks about, absolute Christian science. So, we come to the second level, to that which I tried to show as 1, 2, 3, 4, you see, as 1, 2, 3, 4, which show now what this oneness is, namely as a reciprocal relationship. I begin now to define more closely this oneness as relationships. The relationship first in this oneness which man has to God, you see. Then in the second, which man has to the Christ. Then the third, which man has to Christianity, namely to the idea man. And then the relationship which man has to the science of man. So, in this absolute, from the absolute standpoint, what I do is I get an understanding, an analytical understanding of this oneness of divine science. An understanding that this oneness constitutes of definite spiritual relationships. Where I begin to see, oh, in this oneness I not only have to be one with the Word, I have also to be one with the Christ, I also have to be one with the Christianity, the idea, I have also to be one with the signs of this idea. You see? Then, when we have done that, then we say, yes, but how can I express that? How can I demonstrate that? How can I make that practical? And then you come to the plane of Christian science. Because Christian science, as she says, is the application of the science. As she says, the term Christian science relates especially to science as applied to humanity. See, it's another plane. you can call it a lower plane. It's really not high and low, but perhaps humanly illustrated, we would say the lower plane, where the science, the science is applied to humanity. You see, in the absolute Christian Science, you didn't apply it to humanity. You were understanding what are the relationships within the divine. Within the divine. But now you say, you ask yourself, but what is the relationship to the human? And so in A, B, C, and D, see, we get now the plane of Christian Science. A, B, C, and D give us those attitudes, those qualities, those factors, which from the human standpoint can demonstrate this understanding. So that's why you have ideas, you see, like accepting, like claiming, like being steadfast, like proving. See, these are all qualities which God doesn't need to have by himself. God doesn't have to accept himself. God doesn't have to claim himself. God doesn't have to be steadfastly abiding. God doesn't need to prove himself. See? Is that clear too? That there are very different aspects and levels of being. But the whole together, you see, Mrs. Eddy uses, besides the term divine science, the absolute Christian Science and Christian Science, also the term science. And with this term science, she includes everything into one. So the whole thing together is really science. Science shown first is science. Christianity shown first from the point of view of divine science as man being holy, the saints perfect. Then this Christianity shown in absolute Christian Science by showing, and this man who is that saint, he is a saint because he always has an irrevocable relationship with the Word and with the Christ and with the ideas of God and with the signs of God. And he expresses true Christianity because through the plane of Christian Science, he really accepts this science, he really claims it for himself in every problem, and then third, really abides steadfastly by it in spite of any opposition through hell and high water, and lastly, because in his life he just brings out this science and just lives this science. Is that chart clear what it wants to say? See, it really shows the whole concept of the science of Christianity. And so gives an analysis of it. Now, perhaps one or the other is not used to read such charts. And so I just want to point out something which perhaps for everybody, perhaps for 95% is clear. What this chart therefore wants to show is this, that if I take the column 1, it says, that column 1 says that every epistle in that column, one, like Romans, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, and James, that these four epistles have one common denominator. They have something in common. Namely, that they all show the relationship of God to man and man to God, you see. The grace of God. It's the one. In column 2, you see, all in column 2, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, and Peter, they all have one common denominator. They all turn around to depict man's relationship to the Christ and Christ's relationship to man. The stress there is all about Christ. Then when you have the third column, Colossians, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, and John, the focus there is all on the idea man, how we find our true relationship with the perfect idea man. And so the last column, all four, pastoral epistle, Philemon, Hebrews, Jude, have as a focus the science of man. So that is true, you see. So we always have a common denominator in those four. And that's how we have found this whole structure. That, you see, we have found this whole structure not by just making it fit, but we were studying and pondering Romans, and we are studying and pondering Corinthians, 2nd and 1st, and James, and then we went on and we were studying, say, Galatians and Ephesians, and we just felt they have something different. There's something different about it, something fundamentally different about it. And felt, oh yes, Romans and 1st and 2nd Corinthians, they all showed man's relationship to God and God's relationship to man as a relationship of grace. Whereas the others, they have their weight, their stress on the fullness of Christ, of the working of the fullness of Christ. See, in that way we could categorize these and classify these epistles. Then, you see, first we had that. First we just felt that Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians had a common denominator, which was different from Galatians, Ephesians, and Philippians, and which were again different from Colossians and 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. We just could feel that in the text and see that in the text, that the stress was on something else. But then was the question, well, what differentiates within one set each epistle from the other? What differentiates Romans from 1 Corinthians and 1 Corinthians from 2 Corinthians if they have one common denominator, namely the relationship, point one, you see, man's relationship to God and God's relationship to man. Why did he write three epistles, why not one? And so we began to feel the difference between Romans and 1 Corinthians, and the difference from 1 Corinthians to 2 Corinthians. And so we found out what we tried to epitomize as A, B, C. See, that really differentiates them. That in Romans, you feel that all what he wants to teach is that we should accept the new gospel. That Paul says, I bring you a new gospel and you better accept it. You see? Whereas then in 1 Corinthians, he was not interested so much in saying accept it as to say, and now you have a new foundation, build on it. When you have accepted this new gospel, Romans, then go and build on it, claim it, use it, build on it. That's 1 Corinthians, you see. And then we began to see that when he had said that he was writing again to the Corinthians and said, and you know, if you really stick to it, you may encounter lots of difficulties, but don't give in. Don't give in. If you have the quality of steadfastly abiding in the new faith. See, that's C. If you steadfastly abide in that faith, that has in itself the quality of winning a victory. Of winning a victory. And so, you see how, little by little, just as I have shown you that example of the sculpture, there was just one big block, so to say, 150 pages of Bible text. See, just one big block, that marble. Then one could say, well, oh, I begin to feel what that is all about. It's all about man. told about the new man and man, what man's relationship to God. You begin to feel that the roof under which all these epistles were, that roof which covers all the epistles, that's why I call it the roof category, Christianity, that roof was just showing that the epistles have to do with men.